So this is the interview with Tor Kung on Friday the 27th of October.
Yeah.
So you were just talking about your father.
My father, yes. After the Second World War, around 1946, Aung San and his group, they were part of the governor's they have a council, you know, governing council, and he had already been appointed on the council, together with UNU, and Utan is very close to UNU. They were all headmasters before the war. My father actually worked for the British government, and he was the main headmaster for Rangoon Government High School, the top school in Yangon at that time, before the war. And later, the colonial government sent him to the Xian State as the chief education officer. That was before the war.
Was that school more famous than St. Paul's and Methodist?
No. These are the two different. That is the government school. Of course, we cannot compete with the private schools. It's like that now also. The government schools are... They are not well funded, but before the war, you know, they were quite good and produced a very, very competent, educated people, like Professor Chow Tet and many others. When the war broke out, my father was chief education officer for the Shan States, and then during the Second World War. Dr. Vamo formed the government, and UNU became the foreign minister. And my father was recalled and to come back to Yangon, and he was appointed to the Directorate of Education as an assistant director. After independence, he became a full director. But during that time, interim time, you know, from 47. January of 47 to round about December of 1950, he was sent on a special commission to London, and he had to do three tasks. The first one was that Aung San and his group were going to send a lot of state scholars to UK, some to US also, but mainly to UK. A lot of doctors, engineers, you know, many professionals, because Aung San already knew that many would be leaving Burma when we get our independence. A lot of Indian people, educated professional people, also a lot of British and what we call Anglo-Burmese and Anglo-Indian, you know, and we need Burmese people, young Burmese people, to replace them. So many were sent, you know, and my father, as an educationist, was put in charge of all the state scholars sent to UK and some to US also. But his office was in the Indian High Commissioner's office, because there was no embassy. He was attached to the Indian High Commissioner, because Aung San and Nehru and UNU all have very good relationship, you know. So in London, if you go around, you know, Aldwych, there's a big Indian house there, and my father's office was there. He was supported by the Indian government. Anyway, the first task was the training of the state scholars, because it was very difficult to get admission to British universities, because a lot of young British were coming back to go back to the university after the war. Their education had been interrupted, you know, because of the war, and they were all going back to the university. So for foreign students, it was difficult to get admission. And because my father was educated in UK, he was assigned this task, to see, to go and talk to the rectors and the council, the chancellors and vice chancellors, to get positions for the Burmese young men and women to be trained in UK. So many were sent during those first 3 years, you know, 47 before Aung San died, and then 48 when we got independence, 49. By end of 1950, that program was already going very well. So my father was recalled and appointed the head of the education department under UNU.
Is that like permanent secretary?
No, director general.
Director general,
yeah. But that was the first task. The second task, you can ask Santana. You know Santana? Santana.
Yes, sure, Tanil.
You
know him?
I've met him briefly only, because he knows more about this, my father's involvement with the bank, Bank of England.
The Bank of England, that's what I remember you said about your father.
Yeah, because he had to sign the first bank notes, which were being printed in London.
But as the Director General of Education, why was he signing the bank notes?
Because he was the only representative of the interim government in London. And he had three jobs to do, you know. The first, the main task is the six scholars. The second is the Burmese representative on the currency board. Because the first banknotes were all supported by the Bank of England. And we were in the sterling block, you know. There was no separate Bank of Burma at that time. No, what we call a Union Bank in Yangon. And the third was this embassy. He had to find a building for the embassy and also recruit the local staff. One year before, you know. By December of 47, the first ambassador, you know, Aung San and his group chose a very, very good person. He was knighted by the British during the colonial time, Sir Mangji. He was...
Sir Mangji,
yeah. He was also an educationist before the war and used to be Minister for Education under the colonial regime. And he knew my father very well. And he asked my father to stay on, you know. At first, my father was going to be in UK for just 1 or 2 years. He said, please become my kind of deputy, because he's not familiar with England. My father went to a public school in England when he was about 10 years old, and he graduated from there, came back to the University of Yangon, and went back to London University again, and got 2 degrees from there.
From London University?
Yes, King's College. So he was very familiar with the British system, you know.
Why, I mean, your family must have been well-to-do to be able to send him to public school.
My grandfather, we have a big estate up in Ninjan. Ninjan is north of Bagan, on the Irrawaddy River. I was told that nearly about 100 acres of land.
So very fertile on the banks of the river.
Yes, and they my great-grandfather, he's half Chinese. They planted a lot of mangoes from a new variety imported from India, and they make a lot of money. But my grandfather, his name is Ubato, and then my personal name Tho comes from his name. He joined the British service. He went to university in Calcutta and got a degree, came back, and then he was appointed assistant commissioner for excise. But he died young also. So my my his three sons, you know, he had three sons. My father was the middle one. My father went to UK. My father's elder brother also went to UK, became a barrister, all as private
students. You mean your uncle?
My uncle.
Yeah. So all three boys were educated in the UK?
The eldest one died.
Okay.
Before he had a chance to go to UK. He went into government service, following his father's footsteps as one of the assistant commissioners of excise.
Right.
But he died young, in his 30s, and he didn't go abroad. But anyway, my uncle, my father's elder brother, and my father, they were educated in a public school in Taunton, also called King's. And then my father did very well, you know. He got distinctions in nearly all subjects for the, at that time it's called London Metric.
London Metric.
And that was 1922, so the university had opened in 1920. So he decided to come back, and, you know, and the university said you can join directly to the second year, because he had already done a lot of courses.
And what was his field of study?
English literature.
And then
the postgraduate is education.
At King's First, College.
Yes, first a diploma in teaching, and then later a master's in education. That was supported by the British government. Funded by the British government.
Right.
And then he had to come back after getting his master's to become a headmaster here. And later he became inspector of schools, and then during the war, joined the Directorate of Education, and after independence became the Director General.
And when he passed away, what was his role at that time?
He was Director General of Education, as well as the chairman of this historical commission,
okay,
which he established for UNU.
Right.
In 1955.
And so then bring it back to you now. So you were born in...
37.
What date?
December 17.
1937.
37.
And how many siblings did your father...
I have two sisters. They are both living abroad. One never comes back. She lives just outside of Washington. That's my middle sister, and my younger sister lives in Bangkok, and she comes back for short visits, but no longer resides here. She was in Singapore for about 18 years, because her husband, Dr. Mia Tan, worked with the ISIS, Institute of South Asian Studies.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I was the visiting fellow there, 89.
So what about your childhood here? 1937 was in the middle of the war. What was it?
I didn't have a good education before the war or during the war. I was quite young when the war broke out. And then my health was very poor. I had a kind of arthritis. At that time, they didn't have good medicines also, you know. So I didn't get a proper education. But when I was in UK for 3 years with my father, my whole family, my mother, my two sisters, and we had a very good housekeeper, which we took from Burma. I was educated by a private tutor, a young graduate lady from, she had a diploma in teaching from a college in Cambridge. Later she became a missionary teacher, you know, and married someone who was also a missionary. And they spent most of their life out in Africa, because I went to see them again when they retired and were living in UK. So I went and called on them several times. And their whole life they did a lot of good teaching, but in Africa.
And why did you have a tutor and not go to school like...
But because of my health, you know.
Oh, okay. But your sisters went to normal school.
My younger sister was too young.
Okay.
My middle sister went to a local...
So did you get to... You got to the UK before the war broke out in Burma?
No.
When did you go?
My father went to UK, sent by Aung San's cabinet in January of 47.
Okay, so what was it like?
I was 10.
10. So can you remember your life here during the the Allies retreating and the Japanese coming in?
First memories are of the Shan State, because my father was a chief education officer for the Shan States when the war broke out. And the Sovereigns, you know, the chieftains were very good to him, because he had been working with them and trying to upgrade the education system in the Shan area. So they had a kind of forest kind of retreat, you know, with a big pond and a lot of little buildings that they had built to be out of the, you know, bombing and the Japanese fighting. A lot of Japanese, also some Chinese troops, and of course British troops were fighting in the Shan area. And they had this kind of jungle camp, you know, and they took our whole family with them. Because my father was actually working for the Shan State at that time. Shan State was different, you know, under the British administered differently with the Sovereigns.
And was it safe?
Yes, very safe. And we were in this forest retreat. The Sovereigns had stopped a lot of food. So we were not hungry.
And how long did you stay there?
We were in this area for nearly 6 months.
Wow.
Until Bamor, you know, in
yes.
Yangon,
yeah.
formed the, what we call it, the puppet government under the Japanese. And my father was immediately recalled to come back to Yangon. And he was appointed as the deputy director for education.
Under the Japanese?
Under this government,
okay.
Amor's government.
Right.
And from that time, you know, he became very friendly with Unu. Unu was a headmaster before the war. And Utan was also a headmaster before the war. I remember Unu coming to our house during the war and talking with my father. My father is a little older than Unu and Utan. And they regard him as a elder brother, a mentor, you know, because he was educated abroad and knows a lot about the British system. And anyway, they were very friendly and they got on well. And although my father did not know Aung San personally, I think it was Undu and maybe Utan, I don't know, who recommended that he should be sent to UK in 47.
To do those three things?
Yes, the six scholars.
But your day-to-day life during the Japanese control,
yes.
was just normal, as though there was no...
When we came back from the Shan area, my father built a little hut, you know, in the compound of the Director General for Education, who was his friend also. Also with some Chinese blood. He was from Makwe,
mm-hmm.
In Upper Burma. My father is from Yinjiang, which is quite close, you know. And this my father's boss, he's very nice also, Ucho. He also got the Situ Ucho.
So,
but he retired after independence. So my father became the director general.
Right. But there was no interference in your normal day-to-day life that you can remember during the Japanese period. It was just
A lot of scarcity. We didn't have anything. We just had this little hut in the garden of...
like a thatch roof?
That's bamboo floor.
Bamboo floor.
And we all went and stayed in that area because it's near the Shwedico, on a little hillock, you know, because we knew that the British will never bomb the Shwedico area.
So there are a lot of other people, presumably.
A lot of government officials. And before the war, my father had a very close friend who was my physician, my doctor. Because when I was born also, my legs were not very good. And he was treating me, you know. His name is Dr. Pat Tan. And before the war, he was the chief surgeon and also the superintendent of the Rangoon General Hospital. So he had a house in that, the big hospital downtown. And my father was the head of the government high school, which is opposite, on the same road. It's called Bojo Road now. In the old days, it was Commissioner Road. So his house and my father's house was opposite, you know. So our two families are quite close. And later, you know, his daughter married Ne Win.
Really?
During Ne Win's rise to power, you know, from around about 1950 to until her death in 72. So we knew Katie, we call her Katie, you know, Katie. She was nearly about 8 years older than me. She was very interested in nursing. And I remember after the war, you know, my father was teaching her to play tennis. And then when we were in UK for 3 years, she was there also studying to be a nurse, but she gave up because she married a Burmese doctor and gave birth to her first daughter. And then she used to come to our house nearly every weekend, you know.
So how does she relate to, who's married to Ne Win? Who was married to Ne Win?
She separated from her first husband.
Right.
After getting three daughters.
Okay. And then married Ne Win?
Yes. But her husband could not come back yet because he had not finished his studies. He was going to be a doctor. A state scholar also. But she had to give up this nursing course because she got married and then got this child. And then after 1 year in, 50, early 50, I think, she was expecting again. And she found out that she was going to have twins. So they decided they cannot manage, you know, living in London. The husband studying for his FRCS, and she cannot cope with three young children in the house. So she decided to come back to Yangon. Only the first daughter was born in London. The twins were born here in Yangon. And after that, you know, I don't know how, but she hooked up with Ne Win. Ne Win already had a wife also.
And then, like, Sanda Win is
in that.
Sanda is from
Sanda
the second.
All Katie's daughters.
From the first marriage or the second?
No, second, yeah.
So there must be six children or something, or...
Ne Win had three before marrying Katie.
Right. She
and
had
then
three. She
had
three.
She had three also.
Yeah.
And then they together they have three.
Nine. And Sanda Win is from the...
Sanda is the first eldest daughter.
Right.
And Jimon. Jimon is the younger daughter. And Pyo. Pyo is the only boy.
Right.
And he lives in Germany or somewhere.
So was there interaction between the military and families like yours at that time? Was the military
not?
Like,
not, yeah.
Huh?
Not.
So it not like it became.
No.
So
Nevin was quite informal, you know. I remember when I was young, he used to drop by and then talk with my father. And I was always, you know, I was quite young still, about 12 or 13. I used to watch him, and then he always carried a pistol. But he didn't come with a bodyguard, you know, he just drove
by. He already important then?
Yes.
What was he?
He was already deputy minister, deputy prime minister.
Right.
Because of the rebellion, you know, UNU appointed him as deputy prime minister for a few years.
Was he head of the army or something?
Yes.
Already head of the army?
Commander-in-chief.
So he's a general or whatever, probably not.
But they were quite relaxed, you know, by going around, not much guard.
But then, obviously, it changed.
Changed?
62. Yes. So in 62, you were already 37, 25.
I had come back. I went for further studies in the University of London again, University College, for my postgraduate studies in library studies.
Right.
I went in 60. I joined the university library in 59, and within a few months I was sent as a safe scholar to London, and I stayed there for nearly 2 years. I came back 1961 December to Yangon and rejoined my old post as the deputy to the university librarian.
So just say, can you say a bit about your time at school here, about the, where you were at Methodist?
Yes.
What, were you a boarder at or day boy?
Oh,
or?
We're all day students.
Day students.
There's no boarding. It's not
so,
a boarding school.
So what was it like? What was school like then?
It's very cool. It's one of the best schools in Yangon. St. Paul's was the best for boys. This is a co-educational school. One of the top schools, and we all had to take these what we call Christian names, and they put part of their father's name, you know, and join it together. But my father, being the director of education, you know, he went to see the headmistress, who had worked with him before the war, also said, "I'm going to send all my three children to your school, but they won't take Christian names. They will keep their own names," because we already had family names.
Right.
My father had made
Kang
the family name.
Right.
My sisters had Kang also in their
right.
name. And the only other person who is like us is Aung San Suu Kyi. She didn't take a Christian name. Because
and
Aung San is already in her name.
And did that make, you know, problems with the other students, you know?
No. In my class, my there were only about 10 of us in the class. It's a small class, you know. And they all know that my father is Kao, so they always call me Thor, like a Christian name, you
right.
know. Thor is my personal name.
Yes,
yeah.
Which is not really. It's not like a Western
person. Well, in Burmese, it's,
yeah,
not, you can't separate.
Yeah,
can't
yeah.
separate. But then all my classmates at that time called me Thor.
No nickname, that's your only...
I had a nickname a long time ago, because I was Friday born. Friday born is the guinea pig, you know. We have a symbol for each day.
Right.
And I have a cousin, a first cousin called... Ko is just elder brother, you know, Ko-tu. So I became Ko-pu. Pu is guinea pig. But nobody calls me now like that.
So you're called Ko-pu?
Yes.
Okay.
When I was young.
And was discipline severe at the school, like caning and things
no,
like
that? No caning, but quite strict. We had this we had houses, what they call houses.
Yes.
And then mentors. And then this school I like very much because I founded the Old Students Association. When I was already working in the university library, the headmistress called me and said, we have over 100 graduates from the school now. Why don't you form a Old Student Association? So together with two or three students who were 1 year younger than me, we had formed this association.
Old MLC.
We call it MIOSA, which is Methodist English Old Students Association.
Okay.
Under the military, it collapsed. Although Neil Wynn had sent his daughters there, you know, all his children there. But around about, I think, 96, 97, or somewhere around there, it was revived under a slightly different name, Methodist English High School something.
So immediately in 62, all the schools were nationalized?
Yes.
And so what happened from day one to day two? You know, like day, you're going to school today and it's private, and then the next day it's nationalized.
There was no change immediately.
Right.
The same school, the same class teachers, same teachers. But of course the level went down, you know.
Immediately?
Not immediately, but after 1 or 2 years it went down. Like all the government schools, if you compare the international schools in Yangon with the government schools, we all send our grandchildren to international schools. Their level is maybe 3 grades higher.
Right. But of course they've only come in the last couple of years, haven't they, few years?
Yes.
Yeah.
My eldest granddaughter has been in Singapore because she went to a private school and her grades are good, you know, she can go to Singapore and she's studying there, getting her first degree soon. And another granddaughter is a son of Tant, my bookseller's son. she's doing very well in Sydney.
Oh, so
as a medical student.
Really?
Yeah.
You haven't
very tough to get.
Very tough. I would never get into it.
Yeah, she said she has to study a lot.
Wow, that's where I'll be spending a lot more time.
Oh.
So, is it Sydney University or at New South University?
At New South Wales.
New South Wales, okay.
And she stays in a dormitory.
Wonderful. She must have done
very well.
She comes
back. She did very well, you know, very well. You know. She's always top of the class in the international school.
Wow.
And
what year is she in?
She's in her second year.
Second year,
now.
Okay.
Second year.
Fantastic. Right. Fantastic. And so
I have one grandson who lives in Tokyo. He is only in the high grade before. He's only about 13. But he also goes to an American international school in Tokyo.
And why is he there?
Because my youngest son, I sent him to London for... he wanted to be an accountant. My wife is an accountant. And he took this chartered accountant exam. It took him 5 years to stay in UK. First he had to do the London GCE A grades. And then this chartered accountancy course. But he did well. And he was offered a job in Singapore. And he also took another degree from Singapore in accounting. And he soon after, you know, the Singaporeans, because he married a Chinese girl while he was in London, he fell in love with a Chinese girl who was his classmate from Hong Kong. And they just, at first they thought of staying in Hong Kong, but it was more difficult to get a job. So they went to Singapore, and within 10 years, you know, they are all Singaporeans now.
And how is the son in, sorry, how is the grandson in Tokyo then? How did that happen?
He was born in Singapore, so he will have to do the military service.
Yeah.
But my son has been working for the Takeda Pharmaceutical. And he's now become quite a high position, you know. Head of the financial manager for global finance. They have a lot of branches.
Sure, it's a big
and so he was called to the headquarters, which is in Tokyo. And very good, you know, amenities. They give full schooling for the son and free housing and a lot of, you know, perks.
A lot of perks. And then go back to your career then. You know, you did the degrees in London.
Yes.
Then you came back.
Yes. I was saying I came back in December of 61.
Yeah.
And within 2 months, everything changed, you know. 62, March 2nd. That is, I was back in December of 61, January, February, and beginning of March, everything changed. And for the next 15 years, I could not go anywhere.
Couldn't leave the country.
No. For the first 5 years or so, there were no visitors, no foreign visitors, no foreign contacts, nothing.
And what were you doing?
So what I did was, you know, I could not, I had many friends, librarians, friends outside in UK and US. So what I did was, I went around to the monasteries to collect manuscripts, you know. So I built up a very big collection, you know. And for that, I got prizes afterwards. The Japanese gave me a prize, and then from Australia, I got this honorary doctorate, mainly for my work with old manuscripts.
And is that what you got your Situ for as well?
Situ is different. Situ is given, I got it only in 2012, under Teng Seng. Teng Seng, it's part of the Independence Day honors. And in end of January of 2011, some, you know, I think the army intelligence people, they come to my house and say, you have to come to the Lipido next beginning of January. And they won't tell me what for, you know. So, and later I found out that I have to go to this reception given by Teng Seng. And I was going to be awarded this Situ title, which the president will give personally, you know, with a big slash and something, and quite precious gold. But I said, I had been to Nipido just once before to get my Life Achievement Award in literature. So I said, I'm not feeling too well, and I don't want to go.
But they still gave it to you.
So I said, I would like to get it in absentia.
Which they did?
They came and delivered it here.
So you just, so you went around collecting manuscripts from monasteries, but were you paid anything? Did you have employment?
I was the university librarian.
So you kept getting, although very little money, right, at that time?
Our foreign exchange went down.
Yeah.
And of course, later on, it's zero. We don't get any foreign exchange. But my post was a professor's post. And the pay was 1,400. That's the top head of department and professor. I was also teaching. I established the first teaching department.
So do you know what that would have been in dollars at that time?
In dollars?
Roughly.
At that time was about 20, I think, 20, 25 to a dollar.
So it's a 1400, so it's about $60 a month or something.
But then I had the housing, you know, a very big colonial house built by the British with about 1 acre of the garden and a very large house for which I paid only about $2.
Wow.
And my children, my three sons, are sent to the practicing school attached to the Institute of Education for the staff members, you know, we get priority. So they got good education there.
So you didn't leave the country between 62 and 7, 15 70, years, 7? 76.
And that's when I first went to Australia.
Right.
Australia. Because our Deputy Minister for Education, Nyingi, I don't know whether you met him, he and I worked together on the Burma Research Society. He was the secretary, I was the publisher and the honorary librarian. My father used to be the vice president before he died. And Nyingi became the Deputy Minister for Education. And then he was promoted and then became Minister for Mines, because he used to be Professor of Geology. He also went to University of London, to Imperial College. And then they ransacked him. He lost his job as the minister. But to sort of alleviate, you know, the fall, Nguyen appointed him ambassador to Australia.
And what, he invited you to come?
He got me a Colombo Plan scholarship, because I had established the teaching department for library studies in 1971. Without any training in how to teach librarianship, you know, it's a separate course.
Of course.
Methods of teaching library studies. So he got me a special course in Curtin. At that time, it's called WAIT.
Yes, in Western Australia. I'm a professor at Curtin.
Really?
Yeah.
I enjoy myself very much, you know, because that was the first time I was able to go outside the country in 15 years. And of course, it's all different, you know, for me. Even the automatic doors, you know, I had not seen before. In the airport in Bangkok, you know, doors are automatic.
But I can remember you could take no money.
No money.
So what did you do? How did you?
The Colombo Plan scholarship is not bad, you know. We were put up in a small hotel in Perth, downtown. And then they arranged a small bus. There were only 15 of us from Sri Lanka, Fiji, some from Africa. This small bus would come and pick us up, and we spend the whole day in Curtin.
And you left your family here?
Yes. That was only for 3 months.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, short course.
Okay.
And then I had this, the last month I would travel. Nyingi arranged for me to go to Canberra to stay with him in his house. And then Melbourne and Sydney, to look at other library schools and also university libraries. That was my first visit, and then later I went back many times.
Well, you got a degree from New South Wales,
it's
right? An
honorary degree from Western Sydney.
Western Sydney?
Western Sydney.
Was it a doctorate?
It's a doctor of letters. It's a new university.
It is? Well, yeah, I know the University of Western Sydney. No, it's
grown very large.
Very large. It's in an area of big growth.
When I got it, you know, they told me that I'm the first librarian from Southeast Asia to get this. Same with the Japanese also. When I got the Fukuoka Prize for academic studies, they said, you are the only librarian who's ever got this Fuchs Hugo Prize.
So when did it happen? So come back from the, you came back from Curtin,
yeah,
and you continued as the
as a professor of library studies, head of department,
right,
as well as chief librarian of
the National Library.
No, the University Central Library, which was much larger than the National Library.
Right,
and much much bigger and more developed.
And you continued in that role
until 1997, because I had to retire at the age of 60. When I was about 59, I was asked, given two options. I was already working as a part-time member of the Myanmar Historical Commission, which my father had set up. As the chief librarian, I was already a part-time member. I was asked by the Ministry of Education whether I wanted to continue in the university library as a sort of an advisor to the next librarian, or to become a full-time member of the Historical Commission. So I opted for the full-time member because, you know, I've been in the library so long, 40 years.
Yeah.
I thought that was enough, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Serving a lot of people with their thesis, and finding books and papers for them, and you know, a lot of students. I enjoyed it. But I thought I wanted to do some research on my own, to write and take part in seminars and go abroad and be more free. So I joined the Historical Commission, which is quite, it sort of started, it's something good that Newman did, you know. At one time, he appointed me as secretary to the Myanmar Language Commission, which is the companion setup for Burmese language. While I was still chief librarian, I had to do that job also without pay, without extra pay. So I spent a morning in the library. I have to get up very early, from 7 o'clock until 9 o'clock. I have to teach. Then go to the University Central Library until lunchtime, then go over to the Myanmar Language Commission, where I was the secretary. A lot of old people, you know, very knowledgeable in Myanmar language and literature. We took a personal interest, and we did the first dictionaries, Myanmar to Myanmar, Myanmar to English, English to Myanmar.
One thing I'd be interested in, was there a lot of censorship then? Did they go through the libraries, force you to go through the libraries to look for books that would
on,
be...
On paper, we were supposed to give a list of books, all the new books that we get.
What about the old books though? There must have been many books.
They were also asked, we were also asked, so we just give a token. Token.
So there were many...
I was one of the committee members for overlooking the libraries. So what they were afraid of at that time, I think, was not the university libraries and things like that, only the embassy libraries, you know, like the Korean or the Japanese, not so much the Japanese, but maybe the Chinese. The British Consul was closed down, the library. American Center.
But they were always
down.
Concerned about students, the military.
Well, on paper, we are supposed to have only books on socialism.
Yeah.
But we never got rid of the other
books.
You
must have thousands of books on board.
Thousands of them. How can we make a full inventory of the whole collection? It's thousands, tens of thousands. So we just give a token, and then we are supposed to give a monthly record of what we get, you know. So for a few months we give some, and then later I stopped giving.
And they didn't ask anything?
They cannot take action because I'm on a member of their board.
But did you have funds to buy books?
local funds. I got a lot of money for buying manuscripts, and only no foreign exchange.
Right. Yeah. So your passion anyway is the manuscripts, isn't it? Your passion is the old books, old.
We, in the old days, we had a bank account in Blackwells, in Oxford. That's what I love to do. Go to Blackwells. I got very friendly with the grandson of the founder, Miles Blackwell. He passed away, you know. He was younger than me. Anyway, we used to go together.
I'm conscious of your time. How are you? It's
Maybe another 15 minutes.
Okay, it's wonderful. You're very fluent in your recollections. So, there was not that much interference with your job during the Ne Win period.
Another thing, I think, no, that's my personal feeling. It might not be right, but I had a lot of contacts with the embassy, especially the U.S., Australian, and U.K. I used to spend a lot of time in the Australian complex because I couldn't see movies. There were no new movies.
But what was it called? The Platypus Club, or there was a
had a club. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a the residence was on the top of the
hill. Yeah. I used to go there quite often because under the Mills, you know, Pat Mill was a Burmese literature student from London. She was very interested in Burmese literature, and Chris Lam,
of course, you know.
We got on very well, and I sort of joined the club. Then my boys can go swimming, and then the British also, the ambassadors at that time, like Nick Fan, the last one, Molan, Martin Molan, who was here in 88. They had first come to Burma when they were very young, you know, about the same age as me, to study Burmese language. And I had met them at that time, and then when I went to London, I knew them also. So I got on very well with the British ambassadors and used to spend a lot of time in the embassy compound. My sons also swim in the pool, and there's a little club there.
Yeah. Now, one thing I...
But I was not supposed, as a government official, I was not supposed to meet with foreigners, you know. And there's a form you have to fill in. Every time you want to see a foreign visitor, foreigner, you have to get permission first, and then later report on what you talk about.
So what happens when they ask you? They can't ask you for dinner tomorrow night. It had to be for...
I used to go.
Anyway.
And anyway.
Right.
But I have a feeling that I didn't get into serious trouble because I knew the Ne Win family. Not. It might not be directly, but because I was doing some special projects for Ne Win.
Like what?
Dictionary.
The history. The historical
one. Not so much the historical one at that time, but the Burmese language dictionaries. And the grammar. We had to do the grammar and the spelling. Well, there was a lot of controversy with the spelling. And the general took personal interest, and he used to come to the commission also.
So you knew him personally?
Yes.
Yeah.
He used to take us around. Sometimes to Napoli. He has a big house. Not his house, but the army guest house. And he would take some of our commission members, and we have a meeting there. Just to get, he's friendly, you know. So on Sunday we are having this big book launch with, you know, Bob Taylor.
Let me get it for you.
It's one. It's going to be published in in Burmese. Two of my former students translated the whole text into Burmese. Pop is always.
So that's
he
the
used
English.
He used to be Australian, you know.
Who?
Bob Taylor.
Okay.
The author. Because at one time he couldn't come here as an American. He's American, but he couldn't come here. So he changed his nationality and became Australian at one time. Now he lives in UK.
So is this written after Ne Win stepped down, or is this written?
Oh, long time after. He never met Ne Win. He couldn't meet Ne Win. But Ne Win is a very never gave interviews. We asked for oral history that he should speak about his life, you know,
yeah.
Which is interesting.
Correct.
And his wife, after Katie died, you know, he married this Nini Mien, who's a historian, and he was working with us, you know, in the same department. But he does never, he's very, I don't know how you call it, reclusive, or he doesn't want to talk about his. He doesn't like this personality cult also.
Right.
But he can be very friendly, but with us, with people who are not interested in politics or anything. But he can be very rough with his own people, with his generals, and sometimes beat them up also, I think. But with us, he's very good.
It's a very big book, isn't it? It's a mammoth book.
Bob has...
So dedicate, you mentioned in the... Let me have a look.
He gives me credit.
Oh yeah, Torkang. Tide librarian, historian, literary cricket and research. Research bank extraordinaire has assisted me in innumerable ways. Not only with this book, but with almost everything else that I have written. What a wonderful compliment.
So on Sunday I have to go to this book launch. The Burmese edition will come out, and there's going to be a press conference, and it'll be, the people who will come will be very critical, because he tried to say only about the political impact of Ne Win, and doesn't go into his personal life.
This is all about his political.
It's the political biography.
Nothing about
only very small parts about his personal life. And
well, that's going to be a fun day on Sunday.
Yeah.
Can I ask you one last question, which you don't have to answer? Do you, as a historian, you know, have a view on the Rohingya issue? You know, like,
yes.
Where is it really? You know, what's the historical thing to it? Because it just seems so deeply felt by the Burmese.
Yes.
The feeling of antipathy towards the Rohingya.
Because you know, they have not. Integrated. We have a lot of immigration from the Yunnan side also. Even for our ancestors, you know, we are from the eastern seaboard of China, Fujian, Canton, that side, you know. Our ancestors, great-grandfathers, you know, came when they were very poor. But they integrated with they married a Burmese woman, they integrated and they become good Buddhists, donate to the pagoda and support the monasteries. And they just become Burmese. We don't have any, my father never had any connection with the Chinese, he cannot speak Chinese. He's more Anglophile. He went to UK many times. For the Rohingya, you see, there have been Ladeshi. Some came with the British. Some are very recent. They cannot speak Burmese or even Rakhine, the Rakhine dialect. And they don't integrate with Rakhine. And what happens is in the border area and near the seacoast also, in many of the villages, over 95% are all these Bangladeshi Muslims. And they threaten the Arakanese, you know. I was told by one Arakanese friend that the fishermen, the local fishermen, can no longer go out because the Bangladeshis have monopolized the fishing areas, and they threaten the Arakanese, so they don't dare to go out, and they have to move out, and the whole area become gradually like an extension of Bangladesh. And of course now they are getting some, not all, but a few are getting radicalized from the Middle East, and they have formed this army, a rebel army, which the Burmese army will not tolerate. You know. So,
do you see a resolution? Do you see?
Under the law that Nguyen made during his time, you to be a full citizen of Burma, you know law more than me, I think. You have to be here at least 3 generations. You have to prove that. So we didn't have any problem because we don't even know our great grandfather's name. You know. We know that he's from China, but I don't know how he ended up in Mianjian in the north. And then on my mother's side is Monmin and Baluchon, that island. We don't know anything about them, but when they came, they were very poor. They were poor, but they made money here, and they became Burmese. In Yangon, we have a lot of Burmese. A lot of Burmese Muslims, and we don't have problems with them. The chief librarian in Yangon University Library is Muslim, but a Burmese Muslim. And we have no trouble, you know, no problem with that.
How do you distinguish between him and, he's Burmese, so he's considered Burmese, not from India or from Bangladesh?
They have been, this librarian, my student, former student, her ancestors came many years ago, maybe 3 generations or more. She's just like any Burmese lady. Her features are a little Indian, but she takes part in the Buddhist ceremonies and all that, everything. Only she won't take the poke.
But can you see a resolution in the short term to this problem?
Under this Nguyen's law, you have to prove that your ancestors have been here for 3 generations. How can you prove it? How can these people prove it?
Which is unfair?
Well, I don't know whether you would say unfair, but the former head of the commission about under Tengsin, a friend of mine called Dr. Myo Mien, he's a history graduate, PhD from Cornell University, and very acknowledged, very nice person. He said, The Rohingya, the government doesn't recognize the name also. They want to be known as Rohingyas because they want to ask for a separate state. If they, in the census, you know, under the British, there was no Rohingya. So in the recent census also, there's no Rohingya. But anyway, they wanted to be known as Rohingya, so that they can ask for a separate a part of Rakhine to be a Rohingya state, which is going to be a Muslim state. That is not the way to for immigrants to demand, you know. You have to integrate with the local people, and then you can live peacefully with them. But this is a problem. They don't even learn the language. So in Australia, you know, I like music a lot, and you have nice songs. We are all Australian. We come from all different parts.
Yeah, we're also a new immigrant country.
Yeah. But then Singapore also, of course.
Correct.
But there are programs you do to
integrate. Like the HDB, where each has to be mixed races in
that's
the housing.
That's what Aung San Suu Kyi knows that very well and has that in mind. But I don't know whether she can work it out with the military. The military is very much against and the Rakhine, of course. Rakhine also very much against.
I think I should stop. I've just pressed stop.